Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. I want to welcome you today to part three of our three-part menopause series, episodes 38, 39, and 40. Today, we're going to talk about nutrition in midlife and beyond. And in case you didn't know, diet culture is huge in the menopause space right now. We'll also cover off on bone health, movement, and more. Here to help us debunk the menopause misinformation is dietitian and certified menopause practitioner with the Menopause Society, Val Schonberg. Val is a registered dietitian with a Master of Science degree in nutrition from the University of Minnesota. She is board certified as a specialist in sports dietetics. She specializes in eating disorders, sports nutrition, and midlife health. She owns a private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, where she serves as a consulting dietitian for Emory Sports Medicine and Orthopedics, the Atlanta Ballet, and the Atlanta Dream Women's NBA team. She is a fellow of nutrition and dietetics and received the Excellence in Women's Health Award from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Women's Health Dietetic Practice Group. Val, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited for our conversation today.
I am too. I wanted to start off by telling you something that I notice in the menopause literature. I notice a double bind message when it comes to midlife and beyond. On one hand, I see a lot written about all of the wisdom that comes from the accumulated life experience. But on the other hand, I see just as much written about not being able to trust things like quote unquote eating in response to the body's wisdom. It's almost like the message is you can really trust yourself now that you have all of this wisdom, but not your body.
Well, I think it's fascinating that that paradigm exists, right? Because it really is true that for women, as we come into midlife, and certainly through the menopause transition and beyond, we are older and wiser. And I'm super passionate about helping women, you know, own that part of their life, you know, what they do know about themselves, what they know about their families, all of their accomplishments, and this wisdom that we can bring into aging. And so then when I see or read in the same kind of literature where there's this idea that we need to change how we're eating or change how we approach health and wellness, to me, that is just, you know, a big red flag of diet culture. And I think it preys on women from the standpoint that, I mean, I am of that age, and the reality of health and wellness concerns is real, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're no longer a 20-something-year-old who might get osteoporosis someday. It's that we are going to the mammograms, and we are going to, or hopefully people are going to their mammograms and their colonoscopies and their preventive wellness checks. And so it really is this imminent, like, we care about our health, right? It's tapping into women's values about health and then spinning it that, well, there's something magical and different that you need to do now that you didn't need to do before. And that really isn't true. And I think that's what preys on women's, you know, confusion and misunderstanding about that there's that they need to change how they approach their food, eating, and their body.
Yeah. And you and I are both in the same field. We have different scopes of practice, but I imagine we've both been doing, we've both been eating in an attuned way, otherwise known as intuitive eating, for lots of years now, which is not most of the population. So when I'm reading, like I said, about all this accumulated wisdom, but then the double bind message about not being able to listen to your body and seeing these prescribed things like intermittent fasting and not eating sugar, it's confusing to me. And I've been in the field for over 24, 25 years now. I can't imagine how confusing it is for the general population that doesn't happen to be in this particular field.
Yeah. And I think you're tapping into something really interesting to me too. So I think that there certainly are women who have maybe been entangled in diet culture for many years. So intermittent fasting or keto or some of that just kind of becomes the next diet du jour. But But for many women who have naturally been intuitive eaters, that's, you know, where I want to come back to. No. Like you know how to tune into your body. You know how to pay attention to how your body feels in terms of hunger and fullness, or, you know, maybe how stress negatively interrupts your hunger and fullness cues. Mm. And so none of that has really changed. And so it's really taking back and owning intuitive eating that, yeah, some things change when we go through this. You might feel hungrier in the morning than you used to be. You know, we would respond to it in the same way. Well, if you feel really hungry, it's a really good idea to go seek out food and feed your body. The same might be true. I hear some women say they're not as hungry in the afternoon, for example, whereas maybe they always would have a snack and they just don't feel as hungry at that time for different reasons. Should they have a snack anyway? And, you know, I think that those are, it varies based on the individual circumstances, how active they are, all of those different factors. But nothing has really changed in terms of how we tune into our body, pay attention to nourishing it. And we might be more intentional, right? We might be a little bit more wanting to change some things around in terms of meal planning, because maybe you were cooking for six people and now you're cooking for one or two people. Some of those things might be shifting and changing. But the idea that we have to magically remove a food or eat differently isn't necessarily true for most people.
When I'm reading in some of the books about like no sugar, for example, all it really makes me want to do is eat more sugar. It's sort of like telling yourself not to think about purple elephants, mm-hmm. right? So when you speak about gentle nutrition and maybe adding some things in without taking things away, what might that look like in this particular stage of life?
Yeah. And then I think that's where it's really an individual situation. If I were going to talk in terms of generalizations, so I'm always careful about generalizations, because then I think this is where women get confused. Mm-hmm. But so just so your listeners know, this is a general idea that if we look at the different like buckets of health that we know become something we want to be more attentive to in aging, this is heart disease, right? Like heart disease is a leading cause of mortality in women after age 50. Bone health, right? Like mm-hmm. the imminent risk of low bone density or osteoporosis is something really important that we want to tend to. Certainly some individuals may be at an increased risk of diabetes. That could be for genetic reasons. That could be for a lot of reasons. So we want to pay attention to that. And certainly cancer health, right? When we're concerned about colon cancer, breast cancer. But then there's mental health, right? So there's this other space that we really need to, in any of our interventions for those other health or disease risks, we want to make sure that we're thinking of this whole biological, psychological, social element of a person's health. So from a heart health standpoint, we would definitely want to make sure we have good sources of fiber, rich food in our diet, not at any extreme, but just, you know, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and beans and legumes and some of those good fiber-containing foods. When we think about bone health, we're thinking of calcium-rich foods, which are dairy foods. Certainly, there are a lot of other non-dairy sources of calcium, like almonds or oranges or collard greens, and vitamin D, which someone, you know, if they aren't out in the sun as much, they might need a vitamin D supplement. Omega-3s, so we can get those from salmon or walnuts or other good sources of, you know, fish oil that might, or not vegetarian sources of that omega-3 fatty acid. So it's those general principles. And if we're practicing a food first approach where we are eating consistently, regular meals that sound good and are pleasurable, we generally shouldn't have to worry about most of those nutrients.
Okay.
And unless someone's showing up, and let's say that you do start to see you come in and you see me in an orthopedic clinic and we're like, whoa, okay, we have some low bone density. Let's be really mindful about, are you getting adequate sources of calcium regularly in your diet? Or are you super busy and stressed and anxious? So sometimes you're just unintentionally not eating very much.
Okay.
Right? So then we might not be getting enough protein, which also is really important for our bone health. So instead of the idea that thou shalt eat more protein and less carbohydrate, I like to start from the standpoint of, well, what are you doing in terms of your eating? I think sugar is the same way. When I hear people like obsess over the sugar in their diet, I'm like, well, you know, ketchup is a great example where someone will be really worried about the sugar in ketchup. I'm like, well, how much ketchup are you eating in a day? Like, don't eat a lot of ketchup in the month. Like, so I think it's, let's put it all in perspective into what is your usual eating pattern. And again, this would circle us all the way back to intuitive eating and gentle nutrition in terms of being mindful about eating regularly and consistently, you know, foods that you enjoy, a variety of different foods. And I know this isn't sexy, but balanced variety and moderation really can be a good mantra to come back to in terms of that overall nourishment.
I know that there's a lot of messaging in midlife around like your metabolism is slowing down. You don't need to eat as much as you used to. You need to adjust your intake. What do you have to say about that?
Well, whenever metabolism comes up in the conversation, you know, I am a nutrition nerd in terms of a science. I mean, I think my energy balance and metabolism class was probably my favorite class in graduate school. I love memorizing things. So when someone says metabolism, I have this image of this super, super complicated and huge, gigantic poster that I could have on my wall that talks about what metabolism is, which is all of these really complex processes that are happening in our body so that our body is able to take nutrients from food that we eat and use it to do a bunch of different things for our body. And when we're growing, right, metabolism is kind of that catch-all word for growth and development and reproduction, and all of those things cost energy to make all those metabolic processes happen. So when we get into, say, our fifth decade of life and beyond, well, things are slowing down a little bit. Absolutely. Well, first of all, we're not really having this costly reproductive system if you're postmenopausal. But that doesn't mean that our immune system isn't trying to keep us alive and healthy, that our digestive system needs to work, our brain, our cognitive health. And so I think what happens is metabolism often gets equated to just being a numbers-based thing. It's about how many calories are you burning? And that's a very complicated thing to identify unless you go into a metabolic chamber at the National Institute of Health and they do some complicated study on you. But underneath that question generally has something to do with a fear of weight gain, right? Or the shifting body change. So if we just know what that number is, then we can control it. And I think metabolism, again, is a very complicated bunch of chemical processes in our body that we don't need to control. You know, we can trust our body that it's going to keep working for us the way it's supposed to when we just, again, eat intuitively, eat enough food on a regular basis. So to kind of bring it down to, well, our metabolism is slowing down, so then you should shift and change and eat different or less. I don't know that anyone could tell you for sure what that would really look like instead of really trusting your own body and the cues that it's giving you.
I am 53. Is that right? I'm officially at the age where I can't quite remember anymore, but 53. And I'm very active. I play singles tennis at least a couple of times each week. And if I were to eat less, I would be restricting my food. My body is definitely not giving me the message to eat less. But it's interesting because with metabolism and the science around it that you mentioned, a lot of people like to refute that science, don't they?
Yeah. Tell me more about what you mean. Like, what do you hear in terms of them refuting the science?
Refuting science. So, you know, we can hear and be educated and get the skills acquisition around what our metabolism is. And, you know, you mentioned things like our resting metabolism. And I don't know that people understand quite how much energy a body needs just to lay on the couch and do nothing. But they can hear about that and still not really buy into it and eat below that metabolic, what would you call it, metabolic rate anyway, in the name of intentional weight loss.
Right, right. That's such a good point. So even if we did have an idea, let's say that we measured it through indirect calorimetry, which I've done a lot of in my work and day, which is, okay, we have a sense of what how many calories or how much energy it costs for your body to just lay on the couch and breathe and digest and be alive, right? And I would say most women that I see, and even if you look at studies that aren't even looking at calorie intake, a lot of times postmenopausal women or even perimenopausal women are eating less than what we would quote unquote predict that their body needs to just survive, let alone go out and play tennis,
right,
or go do the laundry or go rake the leaves. And so that's where this idea that calories in equals calories out just doesn't work out.
Right.
Like that's just kind of this simplistic equation that we've all been confused by because of things like the watches and the numbers and MyFitnessPal and, you know, calculating all this stuff. But that isn't the way the body works. So if someone is chronically under consuming the amount we would predict they need, well, part of that is that the body has really adapted to potentially to keeping you alive because it doesn't have enough. So it turns down different energy systems. And then, you know, if we're adequately fueling our body, theoretically, our body is going to kick up and be able to be more efficient, you know, work better, actually. So when we think about sports and athletes, even just casual exercisers, for example, if they're not fueling enough for that activity, it might feel a lot harder to do. And they might feel a little sluggish and they might feel more sore. And so with more adequate fueling, the body, you know, and the muscles and the heart and the lungs have more energy to actually do what the way it's supposed to be working. But the idea that we can really accurately measure this in our, you know, kind of clinical environment, that's not very easy to do. And even if we can, so even when I've worked in this situation where someone's like, I just want to know what my resting metabolic rate is, I'm like, okay, but what are we going to do with that information?
Like, well said.
Right? Like, what are we going to do with that once we have those numbers? Or now are you going to calculate that every single day? Because that doesn't sound like very much fun.
As if we're machines. Right.
And that becomes really disruptive. And I would just tell you that my professional experience is it doesn't add up. So it will drive you crazy. Right? Like it doesn't match. I've seen many people where we've measured their metabolism, their resting metabolic rate. I know because of, you know, maybe usually someone with an eating disorder, you know, how much they are putting in their body and it doesn't work out. They should be losing weight hand over fist, but they're not. Their body has plateaued or stabilized because it's a protective mechanism. The body will do everything possible to keep us alive. And that's why I often say your body will adapt, quote unquote, good or bad, to whatever you do consistently. So if you're under eating consistently over a long period of time, your body has adapted to that. And if you eat intuitively, right? So you're eating according to your hunger, then your body will probably be where it's supposed to be. And that, I think, in today's wellness and diet culture and a fixation on the way our bodies should look or that we shouldn't change or that we should be a certain size. And a lot of this was, you know, has been driven by BMI and some of the labeling. Then women are really thrown off.
Right.
Because they go into the doctor's office and they've gained, you know, a certain amount of weight and then they end up in some BMI classification language that really can be disturbing. And so there's a lot of messaging that we need to do in terms of re-educating around, well, first of all, BMI classifications are not helpful at all. And we're trying to get rid of that system. But to refocus on what you can control around your health and activity and some of those kinds of pieces.
When we think of the numbers that you and I are intentionally not saying for very good reason, and things like the BMI and fad diets, those are all things that disconnect us from the body's wisdom. They disembody us and kind of get us, you know, making our food choices from the chin up versus being more attuned, like we said, attuned eating. If we are under consuming, whether it's intentional or not, it turns down metabolic systems. And one of the metabolic systems that I think about as we're entering into midlife or maybe before would be our cycle. I wonder, how would you know the difference between somebody, say, in their, I don't know, late 30s, entering into their 40s, who had a disruption in their menstrual cycle? How would you know that that's perimenopause versus amenorrhea or relative energy deficiency in sport?
Yes, that's a great question and something that I do see pretty frequently in the sports medicine clinic that I work in. And what happens is that, you know, first of all, I think just our in the female athlete space, the intensity of some of the training that women are doing for all good reasons, right? It's fun. There's
Absolutely.
A lot of competitive opportunities and they enjoy that. And that, you know, that brings a lot of value to their life and that's great. But then there's a lot of messaging around, you know, potentially eating a certain way or which contributes to this underfueling. So I've seen this where women will start to notice some signs, like they might start with iron deficiency, which would be like someone tests their ferritin, which is a storage form of iron, and discover that it's on the low end of normal, and it gets dismissed. And then they end up with iron deficiency anemia, and then it gets dismissed because, well, you're a runner. And then they might recognize that they're losing hair more frequently. And then they start experiencing sleep disturbances. And then they start to have irregular menstrual cycles. And then they talk to someone and they're 38 years old and they say, oh, that's perimenopause.
Because
all of those symptoms can come along with perimenopause. Well, by the time they reach me, they've usually suffered through some type of a bone stress injury. And so we are seeing them intentionally in terms of healing and nutrition. And so when I do a nutrition assessment, I'm looking at what is the amount of activity you're doing? What is it that you eat on a regular basis? Not only the types of foods, but how much? And that can be our first, you know, inclination that, well, this looks like you're underfueling. So, you know, generally from that standpoint, whether it's perimenopause or not, the intervention needs to be, we have to adequately fuel for the amount of activity you're doing so that your bones can heal and that you can get back to your sport. That's our first, you know,
I see. So at first you wouldn't know what is what.
Right. And we're not really looking at it from that standpoint. I would say that most cases that I've seen, especially, and this is why I love working with athletes, because oftentimes women are surprised when they realize like, oh, you know, we're going to start you with this iron supplement to get your iron back online. We're going to, you know, increase your eating consistently iron containing foods. We're going to focus on calcium and protein and adequate amounts of these nutrients. We're going to bring carbohydrates back on board because somehow those got, you know, dumped a while back and they start to feel better. Right? They start to feel better, their menstrual cycle comes back, and that's how we kind of can find out that, oh, it really was low energy availability or relative energy deficiency in sport. They get back to their sport. Now, in some cases, you know, we might address, first and foremost, that nutrition assessment, then nutritional rehabilitation, if they're not getting better or they're not getting their period back, and let's say they're under the age of 40, then our recommendation as a team would be to probably recommend like an endocrinologist or, you know, a menopause-related gynecologist to rule out primary ovarian insufficiency, which would be a specific set of hormone testing that they would do to look at, is that something that's going on there? And we often do a lot of hormone testing through our clinic to look at thyroid hormone. That because if thyroid stimulating hormone is low, for example, along with a low thyroid hormone, and a lot of times they're low normal, that can be indicative of low energy availability also. So not just reproductive hormones, because people just want to go test estrogen and that tells you nothing. Okay. And so there's a lot of other things that we can look at to give us clues. All of them are just clues. None of it can be really absolute. But at the end of the day, it still comes back to nutritional rehabilitation, making sure that we have adequate fueling for the amount of activity you're doing. That's the best strategy for your overall health. Because even if someone would have relative energy deficiency in or without sport, right? Like we definitely see this with some of our other individuals. The point is that if you're not giving enough to your body consistently, it's probably stealing away from some system.
Right.
Right. And bone health is one of those, because I spend a lot of time working with individuals in terms of their bone health concerns. That is one of those things that just kind of, it chips away at the bone over time. And we can't really get it back without the use of good prescription medication, which a lot of people don't want to go on prescription medication for a whole bunch of reasons. And so the best way to protect your bones is to prevent excessive loss of bone.
It's so interesting because as you're talking, I'm thinking about how common it is in our culture to see somebody who's doing a lot of activity, a lot of exercise, and think like that's so healthy when it might be. If they are fueling adequately for the energy they're expending, but if they are not, that is not healthy. The body starts I don't know if I'm phrasing this the right way, starts to sort of eat itself, or like you said, steal from the bone.
Yeah. I mean, it's just trying to take care of itself.
Right.
Like it's just going to try to find the substrate anyway. So one of the things I don't think people really quite understand, especially as it relates to calcium, for example. So when we think about bone metabolism, bone architecture, calcium is kind of like stored in the calcium in the bone, right? Mm-hmm. So the role of calcium in the body is really for muscle contraction, nerve conduction, and it's important. So when someone goes and has some blood work done, they'll see that their calcium on their blood work is normal. And they'll always tell me, no, my calcium's fine. My blood work came back, it's totally normal. Well, thank goodness, because if it weren't normal, you'd probably be in the emergency room. Mm. So the reality is that your body will do everything it can to keep your blood calcium levels normal so that your heart continues to beat, not only for muscle contraction as well. So then if you don't get enough calcium from the diet, that could also be from a supplement. I would prefer that we focus on food first, especially in terms of calcium. But if your body doesn't have enough calcium externally from the diet, then it's like, all right, well, we'll just go take a withdrawal from the bone.
One thing you mentioned too that we left out and no one knows it better than you is if an athlete is expending all this energy and not fueling adequately, the heart, a sick heart might be mistaken for a fit heart, which I get from Riley Nichols, our sport colleague.
Yeah. So yes, those are more those clues, right? That, you know, if we see someone with not only low heart rate, but maybe low blood pressure or some other signs that would be indicative of that low energy availability.
So you talked about bone health and the best way to keep our bones strong is really preventative. I've heard you use the metaphor of an IRA. Can you tell us about that metaphor?
Yeah, and that's maybe because I'm at that age, right? Like, I'm 58.
I am
so.
Too. Yes, it resonates.
I've got that year and a half until I can actually maybe take from my IRA without having that huge penalty. So I think that it's a good metaphor in terms of we achieve our peak bone mass, which is, you know, mainly genetically driven. By our 20s, mid-20s, maybe even early 30s. And from that time, for both men and women, we lose bone over time. It's a very slow loss of bone, but we're not building bone during those adult years. Then for women especially, in about the 2 years before and 2 years after that final menstrual period, so this late perimenopausal time frame, is when we see an increased decline in bone density. And it's not really entirely clear. It seems to be related, obviously, to this drop in estrogen that probably happens more so in that late perimenopausal time. But if you look at some of the research, even around follicle stimulating hormone, I mean, perhaps there's a role with that as well. But nevertheless, and we do see low bone density, or we see less bone building, more bone loss in our younger individuals who have low estrogen,
right?
So when we have amenorrhea. So estrogen does seem to have a role in some of those pieces. So late perimenopause, early postmenopause, there's going to be this accelerated decline, and then it tapers off to about 0.5% per year. So it would be in our best interest to do everything possible to not contribute to that loss. Right? It's like a very slow leak. So the last thing we would want to do is widen that leak. And some things that increase that leak is every time a person loses weight, we lose bone mass. We lose lean tissue, which is our muscle, and we lose bone mass. And when people gain the weight back, the body is pretty protective in terms of gaining it back in terms of fat, which people aren't happy about that, but that's just the body being smart and saying, oh, you know, this is a really good way for us to protect the body. And if someone's doing strength training or resistance exercise, then they might be able to get that lean tissue back as well. But we can't really get the bone back. So every time a person loses weight, then gains weight, loses weight, then gains weight, they're losing bone density. And this is well cited in the literature.
Right.
This isn't like something that I only can find in one study. This is cited over and over and over again. So we know this to be true. And but there's other things, right? Like not eating enough unintentionally, not having enough protein, not having enough calcium in the diet. There's some other things we can't control in terms of other disease states and some of those factors, and certainly genetics. But my message really for folks is, hey, be aware of those things that you can do to prevent and, you know, at least not contribute to an accelerated bone loss so that, because most women, if you really think about why are you concerned about your nutrition or why are you concerned about metabolism? If we really start peeling away the layers of the onion, like what is this really about for you? What is it that you most care about? Even if it is weight, right? Even if someone's like, I just don't want to gain weight. And I am happy to sit in that conversation with individuals to understand that. But if we carry it forward into this next season of our life, I don't know about we all have our own unique goals. But I would say for me, I want to be running around and chasing my grandchildren. And I want to be traveling the world and hiking and walking. And, you know, that's, I think, really, I hear from a lot of people. Like, they want to be able to be active and they don't want to end up with some illness, right? So that is really where, again, if we focus on behaviors, if we focus on what we can control with our nutrition and activity versus some of these, you know, trying to control your metabolism, which no one can tell you exactly that, or even our weight, you know, sometimes there's just going to be a weight shift. But those are, I would say not losing and gaining and losing and gaining, which we refer to as weight cycling, would be one of those other behaviors in life to try to avoid.
I like that. So it is protective to not engage in the yo-yo dieting or the weight cycling.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think I saw in your blog, we often say this as well, as a reminder, when you're thinking about the things that you value, like being active, you value those behaviors and that weight is not a behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then if it is something that is causing a person a lot of distress, even if it's just how you feel in your body. So I'm very sensitive to, you know, even if someone isn't necessarily victimized by weight stigma or internalized weight stigma, which is a whole separate thing. But, you know, I do see women who are kind of had the quote unquote, I never had to worry about my weight. And now what the heck is happening? I haven't changed anything about what I'm eating. I exercise still the same way. And I do not understand this change in my body. And recognizing that's uncomfortable. Like, I really mm-hmm. respectfully say that is uncomfortable. I get it. That can contribute to body dissatisfaction, especially in our current culture. But what I want to assure women about is we can work through that, like about the place of embodiment or how you feel in your body and how that is shifting and changing, while still focusing on the values, your passions, other things that we really care about in life. And some of it is just having to turn that ship a little bit. Some of that is some body acceptance that, oh, okay, right. This might be my body's way of protecting as we go into aging. One of the things that, you know, I've witnessed firsthand is seeing individuals who maybe weren't so happy with the extra 20 pounds that they put on through, say, their menopausal years, but then that extra 20 or so pounds really became protective of when they had to go through cancer therapy, right? I mean, yes. You know, I certainly don't want people to gain weight just to protect them from, you know, having to endure chemotherapy, for example. But we don't really understand that. Like, as a science, as a health field, I don't believe anyone really is explaining very well the idea that there are many women who are eating very healthfully and exercising, you know, not in any disordered way, and still are gaining some weight. And when in one research study that I do talk about in my blog, and again, I cannot find this replicated anywhere, so I'm always careful about old dated research, but it's from a 2001 paper that really showed over a 17-year period, women gained on average 22 pounds, and they found this to be a threefold improvement in cardio, you know, in protecting them from mortality risk, largely related to cardiovascular disease. And in fact, there's some research that's just looking at this in terms of our younger women who, you know, have suffered from secondary amenorrhea or even primary amenorrhea. So women in their teens or their 20s, whether it's from relative energy deficiency in sport or another reason. And they're looking at the impact, the negative impact of that on their endothelial function. So the inside mm-hmm. lining of the blood vessels and how that potentially can increase a woman's risk long-term in terms of cardiovascular disease. So we do need to be looking at our health over the whole lifespan, not in just in this, you know, 3 or 4 or 10 years before and after menopause. Like there's, you know, a lot more that goes into what's happening in terms of disease risk and to kind of nail it down to, well, you gained X amount of pounds, thus this is why you are at risk of endometrial cancer is really unfortunate and extremely misleading and potentially shame-based messaging for women.
I look forward to that research that you and I are familiar with in our field. I look forward to the day that it becomes more mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's, I just saw a paper actually where I do think more folks are starting to pay attention to some of this, but some of the language in terms of how we talk about body size isn't shifting. You know, it's kind
right,
of like,
exactly.
It's like the sentiment is kind of there, but the depth of the understanding really isn't. And so, yeah, we have a long way to go, and it feels like an uphill battle for some of us in, I guess, the weight neutral space. I think maybe 10 years ago, women were good to hear, like, okay, yep, I can just trust that my body's okay, even though I'm, you know, gaining weight in my belly or however you want to label it. But in today's diet culture, there's so much information, and certainly even in the healthcare system, that is saying that that change is bad. Mm-hmm. And that it's bad, not just even from, I mean, women can say, look, I don't care about the scale. I'm fine, you know, with my body changing, but I'm worried about my health. Like, they're hearing over and over and over again,
yes,
that because they're having this meno belly, or, and I hate all those labels, that then they have that they have insulin resistance. Like, there's just this equation that if this has happened, you have insulin resistance and you are doomed to have this disease problem. And that is something we really need to untangle, but also respect the fact that women want informed information. Like, it's not enough to just say, it's okay, just accept your body. And at the same time, women need to understand a little bit more and have some reassurance that here's what you need to do to take care of your health. Here's what we do know. Some of this is natural and normal. And at the same time, if you are concerned, here's what we want to pay attention to versus going out and buying. I'm seeing a lot of emphasis on, you know, CGMs or continuous glucose monitoring, and now we need to check our blood sugars every day. And that is really not good recommendations for women. There are so many other things you need to be paying attention to than your fluctuating blood sugars for someone who's otherwise healthy. And so I think that's where the misinformation comes in, mm-hmm. that then contributes to the confusion and even more discontent when their body's changing.
In the first two parts of the menopause series that I'm doing, there was a lot of great information around hormone therapy and the flawed study, what worked about it, what did not work about it. What we didn't cover is, what if you miss that window to do hormone therapy? Let's say you wanted to do hormone therapy, but you missed the window because of age. Or maybe you are not able to take hormone therapy because you have a history of cancer, as you mentioned. What would you suggest?
Well, again, I think it's going to be individualized. So if you look at the Women's Health Initiative study from 2002, and you look at what's happened since then, yes, it did wreak havoc for gynecologists in terms of their recommendations related to hormone therapy. So for the rest of us, what happened because the fallout from that was the supplement space, right? Oh. So now hormones are really bad, and these horrible things are going to happen if you use hormones, which we know is not accurate information, but it opened the door for not only bioidentical hormones that I think were discussed, but also all these supplements, herbal remedies, adaptogens that women can do instead, and that is a way to avoid hormones and keep you, you know, managing symptoms. So that's a problem area as a whole, just because it's a very unregulated industry. But to answer your question, what can women do if they, you know, for whatever reason, do not want to or can't use hormone therapy? Then it's being very careful at saying, well, what is the problem we're trying to address? Like, what is the symptom that you want some help with? And let's say it's hot flashes or night sweats. I would say, like, there's level one evidence for cognitive behavioral therapy for menopausal symptoms, including hot flashes, night sweats, and sleep disturbances. And so that would be one great place for therapists and even dietitians to partner together and deliver that as an intervention. Another might be to consider something like soy foods. So, you know, it's debatable about whether soy foods or isoflavones, which are a component or a chemical in soy foods that may have some natural estrogenic properties. When we eat soy foods, we're not eating estrogen, right? It is not a biologically available source of estrogen. But certain women have potentially some intestinal bacteria that can do this metabolic conversion where it might have an active form. But the research shows that maybe less than a third of North American women even have that particular type of intestinal bacteria. So as you can imagine, they're doing a lot of research to understand that. But soy foods are a high quality protein. They have research in terms of, you know, having some anti-inflammatory and antioxidant capabilities, may even help reduce your risk of heart disease or lower cholesterol. So that might be something that someone could include a daily source of a soy food. And then we could potentially look at certain supplements or lifestyle interventions that may help with whatever that specific symptom is that a woman is looking for some help with. With hot flashes specifically, or vasomotor symptoms, which are the term for hot flashes and night sweats, there is a non-hormonal prescription medication that just came on the market. I believe it was announced in like June of this year. So that is another option. But with prescription medication, I always recommend that my clients talk to their gynecologist or their general practitioner to make sure that that is an appropriate intervention for them. The other thing from a food and nutrition and lifestyle perspective is, to just kind of keep it in its proper place, that whether it's exercise, for example. Some people will be told, like, just do more exercise and that will reduce your hot flashes. Well, there's no evidence to support that. On the other hand, we know that activity and movement is a really good idea and may help with mental health and sleep and some of those other things.
In your blog about weight, the first couple lines where you say, menopause is a natural biological event for half of the human population for which there is no universal experience. So I just want to illuminate what you and I have talked about behind the scenes a little bit. So what I've experienced through the menopause transition has been really different than what you've experienced. And so no one is going to have the same experience. Anyway, I just thought that would be worth noting.
Yeah. And I think it's helpful to put it in that perspective of even the way we think about pregnancy and puberty. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, some of us just kind of sail through pregnancy.
Right.
It's like a great time. And for others, it's horrible. And if all we ever focused on were negative experiences related to these natural biological events, well, that's not very, that's not correct information. And at the same time, we do need to be able to give appropriate interventions for those who are suffering through. So we would never want someone going through the menopause transition to say, well, I guess I should just suck it up and everything should be okay. No, if you're really having intense symptoms, make sure you're working with an informed provider so that you can resolve those in the safest, most informed way possible. But what the research is also showing is that for younger women who are now, since menopause has become this mainstream topic, which is great, it's not such a taboo topic as much anymore, but now younger women are coming into this scared to death.
Yes.
Like this horrible thing is going to happen. And I'm trying to like, no. There's like a bunch of amazing, great things. This is why I love, the book, The Upgrade, in terms of, talking in terms of coming into a better time in life. Like it really can have some stability in terms of your mood. And for someone else, it might be a little bit of a rocky transition.
But even if it's a rocky transition, there does seem to be this increased awareness that can come with more life experience. So, I can create a little more distance if there is some rockiness.
Right. Well, even puberty. I mean, if someone would have told me what puberty was going to be like, I would have done everything possible to avoid it, right?
Exactly.
So I think that, some of it is just the media attention and the misinformation is contributing to some of the problems, as well as the reason that probably the generation before us didn't struggle as much is that if they had some problems, they would go to the doctor and they were just prescribed hormone therapy.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And,
yes.
And now, and I think rightly so, women should question and we need to make sure we can make an informed choice and not just be, delivered, you know, prescriptions because something's wrong with us.
Right.
But women can have that choice. But I think, you know, the last two decades in the menopause space have been just a time of reorganization around how the heck do we treat these symptoms.
Val, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this and reading your blogs. This is exactly the nutrition, bone health, movement, you know, information that I was looking for. And I just want to thank you for helping women unravel what you call the nutrition noise and so much more in the menopause space.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us for the final segment of the three-part series on menopause, the brain, body, and nutrition for Therapy Rocks. Reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'll see you next month.